Here's part two of the horror talk of Larry Ayler. By the early spring of 1983, police in Indiana had tentatively linked several murders of young males committed in the state to the same perpetrator. 6 days after the discovery of McNeve's body, the Indiana State Police conducted a meeting attended by 35 detectives from each of the four jurisdictions where bodies of young males bearing wounds suggesting the same perpetrator had been discovered. This meeting concluded that the same individual had been murdered in each jurisdiction and that all involved in the investigation should form a unified task force dedicated to apprehending the suspect. The four separate murder investigations within Indiana were amalgamated into one, with investigators agreeing that this task force would comprise two detectives from the state police, two from the Indianapolis police, and two from each country involved in the manhunt. This task force, named the Central Indiana Multi-Agency Investigation Team, was commanded by Lieutenant Jerry Campbell of the Indianapolis Police. All information obtained was entered into a computerized database linked to the statewide police system. The coordinated task force, on the first day of the Central Indiana Multi-Agency Investigation Team's existence, the task force contacted the FBI's National Crime Information Center, describing the method of murder and body disposal of the offender they were seeking, and requesting police forces who had discovered young male murder victims whose wounds match this pattern to contact them. Shortly after that, investigators in Kentucky contacted the task force and reported that a 29-year-old Lexington resident named Jay Reynolds had been stabbed to death in Madison County on March 22, and that his body had likely been transported to the site of its discovery. Days later, investigators in Chicago reported... Does rabbit? Okay, that's better. Sorry about that. Chicago reported that the body of an 18-year-old African-American teenager named Jimmy Roberts had been found with 35 stab wounds to his body in Thorn Creek on May 9. Both victims were linked to the manhunt for the same perpetrator, whom this task force termed the highway murderer. On June 6, a former lover of Ayler's named Thomas Henderson phoned the investigation team's confidential hotline to voice his suspicions that Ayler might be the killer they were seeking. He explained that his former lover had been charged with, quote, some sort of stabbing, end quote, of a young hitchhiker in 1978, possessed a violent temper, and had a penchant for bondage. Ooh, interesting. Henderson added that Ayler worked in a liquor store in Greencastle on Saturdays and lived in Terre Haute with an older male on weekends. He also informed investigators that in May 1982, Ayler had drugged a 14-year-old boy, abandoning the unconscious youth in Woodland close to Greencastle. The boy had not been molested, thank goodness, and investigators theorized the reason Ayler had given the boy sedatives was as a means to test the effectiveness of the drug. Conducting a background check on Ayler, investigators discovered he had been arrested in 1978 for attempting to sexually assault a teenage hitchhiker whom he stabbed and left for dead. The handcuffing of the youth's wrists and binding of his ankles matched the modus operandi of the highway murderer, whose victims had also been discovered with welt marks upon their wrists and ankles. Furthermore, Ayler was known to regularly travel between Indianapolis and Chicago. This information was sufficient to keep an informal track of Ayler's whereabouts, but not to place him under full surveillance, because I think the reason why they didn't watch him and not to keep him surveillance, in my opinion, possibly because they weren't sure if he was the suspect they were seeking, and how they needed more evidence to just like find out for sure if that person they were looking for, it was him. FBI profile. At the request of the Central Indiana Multi-Agency Investigation Team, the FBI developed a psychological profile of the unknown killer, whom they predicted to be a white male in his late 20s or early 30s, who worked in a manual profession and who presented a rough exterior in part due to his self-hatred regarding his sexual attraction to other males. The individual would project a macho image and seek the company and approval of other masculine males to feel a sense of belonging. As such, this individual would frequent redneck bars and be something of a night owl, yet live on the edge of homosexual panic. Always fearful of being labeled by others as queer. I see. Because of this fear, this offender may express a hatred of homosexuals just to mask his sexual attraction to those whom he sought acceptance. Furthermore, the FBI predicted that upon completion of the murder, the offender would symbolically erase the act by making a rudimentary effort to cover his victim with leaves or soil, and that this individual likely had a middle-aged, middle-class, and markedly more intelligent accomplice in several of his initial homicides. As many victims had been athletic and lithe in stature, this profile also predicted the offender to be a physically strong individual. The predictions within this profile regarding the offender's strength were supported by the presence of deep welt marks upon the wrists of many victims, suggesting they had struggled to resist being bound and handcuffed. For the murders, on July 2, the partially clad body of an unidentified Hispanic man was discovered in a field 2 miles from the city of Paxton in Ford County, Illinois. This victim had been dead since June 27 or 28 and stabbed in the abandoned. 8 weeks later, on August 31st, a tree trimming crew discovered the body of a further victim, a 28-year-old named Ralph Calise, in a field close to a tollway near Illinois, Route 60. Lake County investigators quickly linked this murder to the stabbing deaths of two other young men whose bodies had been discovered close to this descendant earlier in 1983, Irvin Gibson and Gustavo Herrera. The victim was a 28-year-old named Ralph Calise. He had been stabbed 17 times with a butcher or hunting knife, with several wounds inflicted to his abdomen, causing sections of his small intestine to protrude through his body. In early September, a Chicago-based reporter for WLS-TV named Jera Lynn Kolark noted similarities between the August 31st murder of Calise and the two earlier deaths of young males within Lake County. Kolark was familiar with other murders of young males committed in Indiana bearing similar signature knife mutilations and speculated that the perpetrator of these earlier Indiana murders had begun to murder and or dispose of his victims' bodies in Lake County. Conversing with Cook County investigators, Kolark discovered that a further two young male murder victims who had lived in or disappeared from uptown in 1982 had also been discovered with multiple stab wounds to their bodies and their trousers and underwear pulled down to their ankles in Kankakee County, Illinois, and Lowell, Indiana. On September 8th, investigators from all jurisdictions in both states where these additional bodies had been discovered convened with the senior task force representatives in Crown Point to discuss whether these additional 5 deaths were also linked to the same perpetrator. All 5 murders were added to the list of victims compiled by the task force, whom investigators now believed to have murdered up to 17 young males. 1 month later, on October 4, 2 mushroom hunters discovered a human torso concealed inside a plastic bag in Kenosha County, Wisconsin. The victim was identified as 18-year-old Eric Hansen, who had last been seen alive on September 27 in St. Francis. Hansen's head, arms, and legs had been severed from his torso with a hacksaw. What the hell? And the torso itself had been completely drained of blood. The skull and hands were never found. On October 18, the partially decomposed bodies of 4 further victims were discovered alongside an oak tree close to an abandoned farmhouse in Lake Village, Indiana. Each victim had been dead for several months, and all 4 decedents had been partially buried, with sections of the body of each victim remaining exposed above ground, suggesting the murderer had made only rudimentary efforts to bury each victim. Three of these victims, all Caucasian, were buried at one side of the tree, 3 feet apart, and with their heads facing north. A 4th victim, an unidentified African-American estimated to be aged between 15 and 18, was buried on the other side of the tree. All four victims had been stabbed more than 24 times each, with a blade at least 8 inches in length, and the trousers of each victim were discovered around their ankles. Two months later, on December 7, a hunter discovered the partially buried skeleton of a further victim in Hendricks County, close to U.S. Route 40. The victim was identified as 17-year-old Richard Wayne, who had disappeared on March 20 while traveling from California to his home in Montpelier, Indiana. The body of a second, less decomposed victim was discovered beneath the remnants of a burned mobile home a few feet from where Wayne had been buried. This descendant was determined to be an African American, approximately 5 feet 9 inches in height, although his remains were never identified. Now, the first arrest. So, on September 30, Ayler was arrested in Lowell, Indiana, for a routine traffic violation. He had been in the company of a young hitchhiker at the time of his apprehension. Both men were arrested and detained for questioning at a Lowell State Police post, with Ayler initially being detained upon charges of selecting a young male for sexual purposes after a sergeant named William Cothran, without Ayler's consent and before informing him he was under arrest, had searched his Ford F-Series pickup at the roadside and discovered two sections of nylon rope. His vehicle was impounded. Shortly after 1:30 p.m., two investigators from the Central Indiana Multi-Agency Investigation Team conducted a formal interview with Ayler, whom they informed had become a suspect in a series of murders due to an anonymous phone call received from a former acquaintance of his. Although willing to discuss any other aspect of his life and their suspicions of his having committed murder, Ayler refused to discuss his sexuality. Question about the murders of John Roach and Daniel McNeve. Ayler claimed to have read press coverage of both murders in the Indianapolis Star, but denied ever having committed murders. He consented to the investigators' request to conduct a forensic examination of his vehicle. He also agreed to allow investigators to take his mugshots and copies of his fingerprints and subject him to a polygraph test later. Evidence retrieval, a search of Ayler's vehicle recovered a knife, two sections of nylon rope, handcuffs, a hammer, two baseball bats, a mallet, and a surgical tape. An inspection of Ayler's footwear and vehicle revealed the impressions of his boots to be a precise match to plastered casts taken of imprints discovered alongside the body of Ralph Calise. The pattern of his vehicle's tire tracks was also deemed similar. Moreover, blood was discovered beneath the knife's handle inside his vehicle. He was known to have regularly commuted between three districts in Indiana and Illinois, where several victims' bodies had been discovered. Greencastle, Terre Haute, and Chicago. In addition, Ayler's lifestyle closely matched that predicted upon the psychological profile of the murderer earlier compiled by the FBI. Upon completion of the forensic examination of Ayler's pickup, Indiana investigators informed Ayler he was free to leave custody and retain possession of his vehicle. due to concerns regarding Ayler's knowledge that he was now a murder suspect, might lead to his disposing of any potential evidence. In the early hours of October 1st, investigators from the Central Indiana Multi-Agency Investigation Team obtained a search warrant authorizing their search of the Terre Haute home of Robert Little. The search was conducted at dawn on October 2. It revealed further circumstantial evidence, such as credit card... receipts indicating Ayler's presence in jurisdictions within both Illinois and Indiana on dates identified victims linked to the highway murderer had been killed. An examination of phone bills retrieved from the property revealed Ayler had regularly placed contact had placed collect calls to O'Little's home at odd hours shortly after identified victims were believed to have been murdered. One of these calls to Little's home had been placed from a payphone near the Cook County Hospital on April 8th, the murder day of victim Gustavo Herrera. Hospitalization records revealed Ehler had received treatment for a deep cut to his hand on this date, which he claimed had been caused by a fall from his truck in which he had landed upon a glass beer bottle. Receipts recovered from the property revealed he had purchased handcuffs and a knife the following day. Investigators discovered Ehler and Little had recently spent several weeks on vacation in New York City, returning to Indiana shortly before Kelly's murder. These revelations led a member... Sorry about that. I got scared. Led a member of the Indiana task force named Kathy Berner to remark to her colleagues that if Ehler were not the murderer they were seeking, he was following the actual killer daily. But they don't know that he was the murderer because they didn't have enough evidence to maybe like say, oh, he's a killer or some shit. Almost done. Sorry about that, guys.
Okay.
As the tiger impressions obtained, the Indiana authorities were not suitable for comparison with the impressions obtained at the site of Kalisa's murder. Illinois investigators received approval from a state attorney to seize possession of Ehler's truck. The vehicle was impounded at the Lake County Sheriff's headquarters on the evening of October 2. Ehler accompanied investigators to Waukegan to submit to further questioning by an investigator named Dan Collin. On this occasion, he admitted to Collin his penchant for being the dominant partner in bondage sessions, that his relationship with Dobrovolskis had been something of a love-hate relationship, that he and Dobrovolskis had frequently argued, and that his lover had occasionally struck him. Oh, that's weird, crazy. One second. Whew. Almost done. Okay, sorry about that. He denied that the tire tracks and boot impressions were recovered at the Kelly's murder scene belonged to him, adding that he had never met the victim. Collins stated to Ehler, quote, Larry, we know something about you. You get into a fight with John and pick someone else and stab him because you think it's John, end quote. This accusation caused Ehler to visibly wince. On legal representation, shortly after his release from custody on October 4, Ehler requested legal representation from a Chicago lawyer named Kenneth Ditko Whiskey. Having received confirmation from the Lake County Deputy Chief Investigator that police had insufficient evidence to formally charge his client with murder, Ditko Whiskey filed a civil suit against both the Lake County Sheriff's Police and the Indiana State Police on October 11, citing the harassment of his client and contending investigators in both states have violated the 14th Amendment and Ehler's civil rights by involving him in their collective investigation with insufficient evidence to formally charge him with murder. This suit sought $250,000 in damages against 11 named officers in both states. Jeez, that's crazy. Evidentiary analysis. On October 6, the boot and tire imprints recovered at the scene of Ralph Kalisa's murder were sent to the headquarters of the FBI in Washington, D.C. for further analysis and comparison with all physical evidence recovered by Indiana investigators in the task force efforts to forensically link Ehler to this particular murder. Several days later, the FBI reported to investigators that the boot impressions were a precise match, including
four distinctive wearing areas and the soul's damage. Extensive bloodstains determined to be type A positive were also discovered inside this footwear. Furthermore, the tires on Ayler's vehicle were from two separate manufacturers, and the physical impressions recovered at the murder scene were determined to be from these two separate manufacturers. The tire impressions themselves were a perfect match in terms of grip depth. On October 27, investigators from the Central Indiana Multi-Agency Investigation Team and Lake County held a meeting to determine whether sufficient evidence existed to charge Ayler with murder. The outcome of this meeting convinced officers from the two jurisdictions that sufficient evidence existed to charge Ayler with the murder of Ralph Calise. The following day, investigators obtained a warrant permitting their retrieval of Ayler's hair and blood samples for further comparison with evidence earlier retrieved from Ayler's vehicle to be served the following day, the date of the hearing of Ditko Whiskey's civil suit. The civil suit was heard at the Dirksen Federal Building on October 29 with Ditko Whiskey requesting permission to access the affidavit investigators had used to request a search warrant for Ayler's vehicle. Although Ditko Whiskey argued before Judge Paul Plunkett that, quote, not a scintilla of evidence, end quote, existed against his client, Judge Plunkett, having reviewed the investigators' collective affidavit, ruled that Ditko Whiskey could not obtain access to the documents at the present date. As Ayler walked from this hearing, two Lake County investigators presented Ditko Whiskey's with warrants authorizing the retrieval of Ayler's blood and hair samples. A sample of Ayler's blood revealed his blood type to be O positive. Former murder charge. Ayler was formally charged with Calise's murder on October 29, with his bond being set at $1 million and an initial trial date set for December 19. He protested his innocence, adding in anonymous media interviews that the accusation had harmed his reputation among his family and friends, and proclaiming that had he murdered any individual, real evidence would have existed. On November 1, Lake County investigators obtained a search warrant to conduct a second search of Robert Little's home. The primary purpose of the search warrant was to determine whether the victim's missing t-shirts and wallets had been retained as keepsakes. Although investigators retrieved 221 items of clothing, jewelry, pharmaceuticals, and Polaroid photographs. None of the items recovered depicted or belonged to any of the murder victims. However, a key recovered in this search was a precise match to a key found beneath the body of Stephen Agin. This key was later determined to fit the door of an office where Ayler had worked in 82. With his mother's approval and Little and Dobrovolsky's, a criminal defense attorney named David Shippers was appointed to replace Kenneth Ditko Whiskey as Ayler's legal representative on November 12. Shippers opted to reverse the defense strategy his predecessor adopted, forbidding his client to grant any further investigators to the media. Legality issues. Oh my god, I can't even say hard words. Fuck. Following a lengthy evidentiary hearing in December 1983, Lake County Circuit Judge William Block ruled that although Ayler's initial arrest for the traffic violation had been legally valid, his subsequent detainment, during which evidence was recovered by Indiana police and now presented before him, had been obtained without probable cause, and that Ayler's detention had been illegal. A further hearing to determine whether the defense motions to suppress the physical and circumstantial evidence retrieved by investigators between September 30 and November 22, and to quash and nullify various warrants authorizing these searches and the seizure of property was scheduled for January 23, 1984. Released from custody at the subsequent January 84 hearing to determine whether the physical evidence recovered following Ehlers' arrest should be suppressed, a police sergeant named John Pavlikovic conceded the primary reason Lowell police had prolonged Ehlers' detainment on September 30 was to await the arrival in Lowell of members and of the task force assembled to investigate the series of murders, and that Ehlers had never formally been under arrest concerning any offense other than selecting a male for sexual purposes. Further testimony about the Lake County and Chicago officers' search of the Dobrovolsky residence on October 3 revealed this search had been conducted without a search warrant. Here's a quote from this. The Indiana task force and we were able to working together to trace Larry's movements for an entire year. There are 21 murders that we know of through receipts and bills and what have you. We were able to place him at 9 of the scenes. Here is a date Steve Crockett disappeared. Here is when he was found. And here is where Larry bought gas nearby. Over here is a collect call from the gym where Larry and John Bartlett worked out. Here is what Bartlett disappeared. And here is a gas receipt from practically where Bartlett was found. Don't you see the pattern? He kills and he makes a call. It's his pattern. Now that you got him off, you better hope there aren't any more long distance calls to tear hot. End quote. Lake County investigator Dan Collin, conversing with Ehlers' attorney David Shippers following Judge Block's ruling to suppress much of the evidence against his client. On February 1, 84, following 4 days of testimony, Judge Block adjourned the hearing until January 27 to consider his ruling, informing the assistant state's attorney and David Shippers that sufficient proceedings existed for admitting and suppressing the evidence. On February 1st, Judge Block ruled that although Ehlers had signed a Miranda waiver upon being detained, he had been taken into custody for interrogation upon charges unrelated to the crime of murder and was only later detained on charges of selecting, citing the exclusionary rule as the basis for his decision. Judge Block ruled the physical evidence recovered by Illinois investigators and their comparison of his boot prints and tire tracks to the plaster casts recovered at the Kelly's crime scene had been tainted as the search had been prompted by Ehlers' initial illegal detainment by Indiana investigators in violation of his constitutional rights. Furthermore, although Illinois investigators had obtained possession of Ehlers' boots from their Indiana counterparts through a subpoena, the boots had never been formally seized by Indiana authorities. Block further ruled the facts detailed in the police affidavit to search Robert Little's home were insufficient to obtain a search warrant. Except for Ehlers' tire impressions and hair and blood samples, Block ordered all evidence obtained to be suppressed. Block also reduced Ehlers' bond sum to $10,000 on this date. As a result of this ruling, Ehlers was free from custody on February 6, 1984, his family and Robert Little having paid for the reduced bond fee, of course. Terms imposed upon Ehlers' bond stipulated he was unable to leave Illinois. In attempts to appeal this ruling, prosecutors submitted several legal challenges, including an appeal against the suppression of this evidence to the U.S. Supreme Court. These appeals were unsuccessful. 4 weeks after his release from custody, Ehlers permanently relocated to Chicago. He resided in an apartment complex in Rogers Park with Little, purchasing the furniture within the property, paying the weekly rent, and purchasing a new set of tires for his pickup. At his lawyer's request, Ehlers refused to provide Dobrovolsky's with his new address, although his lover soon discovered where Ehlers lived. Probably Little, who knows, honestly. I'm gonna do part 3 1 second.